This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
The tenor sax music of John Ellis, who was performing with his band in Chicago last night, starts our program off as usual. Our guest today, however, is not a jazz musician, but a poet, Matthew Murray from Urbana. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Good to have you here. Let's start right off. Why don't you begin reading a poem of yours you selected to tell us a little bit about your background. It's called Shoot the Sky.
Yeah, and I often, when I read a poem, I like to give a little introduction just about it so people kind of know where to enter it as they listen. And when I grew up, I went to Catholic schools, and we had to get dressed in uniforms. And like many parents of my, my mom's about 85 now, and of that generation, my dad kept a handgun around the house, and we all the kids knew where it was, and occasionally would look at it.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, and so it was interesting to know that was in the house, and this poem has to do with that, and it's called Shoot the Sky. Getting dressed for fourth grade on a morning like so many mornings. First black socks, then navy blue pants, then a white button-down shirt. Suddenly, outside my window from the backyard, came the loud crack of gunshot. I ran through the house to the kitchen where my sisters were staring out the back door. There on the back steps, my mother stood, strong and calm as bronze, still pointing my father's revolver at the targeted yellow sky. Then he came up behind us, pushing his way through with his startled and sleepy face. She just slowly turned and said, "I don't know, Matt. I just felt like shooting the gun."
A poem called Shoot the Sky by Matthew Murray. This has been published, Matt?
Yeah, I send out my work to small magazines, literary journals, and this one was published quite a few years ago in a periodical called Calliope out of Rhode Island, which was part of their creative writing program. And I think it has since gone under, but a lot of little magazines do.
Sure.
So,
now, in the poem, your mother, the character, your mother in the poem at least, says Matt.
Yes.
Is your father's name was Matt,
yes,
too?
Yes, that's right.
Are you the oldest son?
I'm the only son and the oldest son. I'm the youngest of four children. I have three older sisters.
Three older sisters.
Yes.
Okay. So finally, your parents could name a boy after your father.
Yes. I was actually the third, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. So, when you asked me whether I'd go by Matt or Matthew, of course, as a kid, I was called Little Matt. So I don't go by that anymore. But so.
Now, you're a poet, but you're also a librarian. Tell us about how you got to be a librarian and a poet.
I often wondered how I'd, many years, what I would end up being. I guess that's a something that confronts everyone. After college, I moved to Chicago.
Where were you in college?
I went to school in Central Florida at Stetson University, a small liberal arts college. Actually, at the time, it was affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. During college, I became very interested. I was raised Catholic, as I mentioned, and I got very interested in the Catholic worker movement, sort of peace and social justice movement of the Catholic Church. And so afterwards, I moved to Chicago and lived in a Catholic worker house for about a year. And then, just tried to find something meaningful to do with my life and did a lot of odd jobs, bike messenger, pizza cook, dishwasher. Finally went back to grad school in the mid-80s and got a teaching certification at the University of Iowa, taught for a short while, and then decided I really, really wanted to write and that teaching would not give me enough time. And so I took a job as a bus driver for a mental health center and worked that job for about 4 years and then worked at the mental health center here in town for another 7 or 8 years.
Doing what?
At the mental health center here, I was worked in what they call a psychosocial rehab program. I always described it as basically like doing adult education, except that all your students were people who had been diagnosed with some kind of serious mental illness, be it schizophrenia, bipolar, major depression. So, that was a wonderful, wonderful work. Just a lot of the restrictions from the state of basically having to generate more revenue from Medicaid meant more and more paperwork and less time working with people. Mm. So I love books, and my partner and wife, Carol, had gone to library school a couple years before that, and she works at the Urbana Free Library now. And she suggested, oh, well, you know, you love writing, you love books. Think about library school. It's a good deal. I think you'd like it. And so I did. And I ended up deciding school librarianship I thought would be a good combination of my training as a teacher, my love of books. I like kids. And I would get summers off. And it's been very –
You can write.
And I can write, yes. But always it's been a struggle to keep writing. And I've basically found getting up early in the morning is when I've always done my writing. So I get up usually 4:30, 4:45, and work for an hour or so, and then get everybody ready for school and get everybody up.
Now, you've been the librarian at the Urbana High School for how long?
This is my third year working there, and I worked 2 years before that at Monticello High School.
And how many others on the staff in the library there?
Just me.
Just you. How many students?
We have about 14, between 1,400 and 1,500. It varies.
Goodness.
I had a
big job.
I had a part-time assistant when I first started. And, well, you know, budget cuts have hit everyone. You hit Monticello hard, hit Urbana a little harder. And one of the decisions they had to make was where to cut money. And so our clerical assistants are gone. I have some wonderful parent volunteers who help out. But it's an interesting job. It always changes. As you might guess, I'm doing a lot of different things. I know your brother's a school librarian too, so you've probably...
One of my three brothers, Joel, Joel Shoemaker, is in Iowa City as a librarian in a middle school there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're doing your library, is it called a library or a media center?
I call it the library. Okay. Most people call it the library. I know some of you... I'm a media specialist. That's my official title. But I think people are comfortable with library, and I am too. I think library can encompass all the different jobs that I get to do. So
we're talking with Matthew Murray, who is a poet and, as we just learned, a librarian at the Urbana High School. Let's hear another poem, Matt. What would you choose to read for us next?
Sure. I'm going to read a poem. I read a poem that one had most to do with my mother. And then I thought I'd read one that's, kind of an homage to my dad. My father worked as a bartender all my life. And he had gone to college. He'd graduated from the Citadel, actually. Mm-hmm. And my mother had graduated from high school. And it's always puzzled me. The job my father worked at for all his life was working at a bar in a pretty rundown area of Jacksonville that was, as the years went by, got more dangerous, particularly when the drug trade started affecting that area. And I think it was hard on him, stressful at times, but he stayed at it until he retired. And so he worked unusual hours. We always ate dinner at 3:30, which people were like, oh. I said, well, my dad goes to work at 4.
Sure.
And usually got home around midnight, 1 o'clock. And this is called When He Gets Home from Work at 1 a.m. His rusty green Comet grumbles up the driveway and shuts off. It ticks and creaks as it cools. After a minute, the car door opens, and he steps out with a low groan, his corns and toenails hurt again. Away from the jukebox, dirty smoke and shot glasses of work, he stands quietly for a moment beneath a sky filled with stars. Perhaps he sees to the south the bright dog star, so blue and far away. He jingles his ring of keys and begins muttering. Behind the black-screened window, his 15-year-old son lies in bed listening, catching only a few words. Tired. Oh, God. Time. Sleep. As his father, a pilgrim, hard-pressed between the deaf roof of stars overhead and the hurtful earth underfoot, begins walking toward the front of the house. Then the silence, until the scuffs and knocks of footsteps on the porch and the locks click, his father turning the blessed key.
His father turning the blessed key when he gets home from work at 1 a.m.
Yeah, and the reference to the deaf roof of stars, of course, you know, the stars don't make any sound, but also my father was very hard of hearing, wore a hearing aid all his life, and so I guess that resonates for me there also.
We have a caller on line one of our local lines. We're happy to have people give us comments and questions as we talk on this program. It is live every Sunday afternoon here from 5 to 6 on WILL AM. Go ahead, please, line one.
This is me, and I wanted to ask a question. You mentioned getting up early in the morning. I'm a writer and also a nurse. But anyway, where did the muse come from? I like your poems very much.
Oh, that's awfully. When you ask where did the muse come from?
Yes, yes.
That's an excellent question. I guess it's complicated for me. I would say in high school I had some just wonderful English teachers. And I wanted to write poems like the ones that we were reading in school. I wanted to be able to do that at some point. And I guess I dabbled in it for a while. And then somewhere along the way, I just decided I really wanted to throw a lot more of my effort into doing it and reading and studying other people's poetry and practicing it on a sort of daily basis seemed like the way to go for me. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And let me encourage other listeners who have a question or comment to give us a ring. In Champaign-Urbana, you can reach our local in-studio lines, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL.
I was wondering, you know, I actually did not ask that person to call. But there's a poem in here where the section of why we write. I brought some poems and page 42 called Seeking the Muse.
And well, that would be a good response. Let me give another phone number before you
absolutely.
Need that, Matt. People who are listening via the internet or anywhere in the continental U.S. may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So if you're outside of Champaign-Urbana a little bit where it's a long-distance call or a long way, do use the 1-800 number. 222-WILL. Well, let's hear about the muse.
Sure. And maybe to background this one a little bit is, as anyone knows who has tried to write, there's a lot of pulls in other directions, and especially if you have a family, which I have two sons and a partner. And
how old are your kids?
My oldest is 15 years old, and he's a freshman at the high school, and my youngest is 13, and he's a seventh grader at the middle school. A reference in this poem is made to a Jewish folktale, which is explained in the middle of it. But it was a very lovely tale where a man is essentially just fed up with all the demands being placed on him and the smallness of his village. And he decides he is going to go to paradise. And things get turned right around on him. So this one is called Seeking the Muse. 20 years ago, I set off to find the muse in fields, city streets, libraries, woods, museums. Everywhere I went, I was looking for the muse. In a little notebook, I scribbled descriptions, words, and lines. I was a regular private eye. For years, every morning before going to work, I've worked on my poems. And slowly, they've come, short and long, of love and despair, clever and simple. A few I still don't understand, but never the muse. All these years later, I feel like that man in the Jewish tale who walks away from his boring little village, the drudgery of work, his wife and children, and sets off for paradise. Halfway there, while asleep for the night, he gets turned around by an imp or an angel, so that when he ends up back where he started from, he's not sure where he is, heaven or home, paradise or earth. Like him, I often sit with my coffee in the morning after writing in our sleeping house, after making breakfast and lunches for my two boys, after looking at my wife's gentle chin, and I stare out the window without saying a word. What could I say? How could I put it into words?
A poem, Seeking the Muse, by Matthew Murray, who just read it for us. Has that been published, Matt?
That one has not, no. So
So any publishers out there listening could give you a call, I'm sure.
Well, you know, it's funny. People do ask, I guess, you know, well, and actually I had a teacher very recently just ask if I would give some information about the publishing process. And I know you've published some of your poems too.
I've been published in magazines and journals and periodicals, yes. But nothing as a book or anything.
Yes.
So tell us how you got started publishing. What was your first poem that was published?
Well, you know, it's funny. I guess I wrote for a couple years and got a lot of rejections, which I was led to understand was the case for most people, unless you're very lucky. The first publication I got was in 1989 from Kansas Quarterly. And I just remember opening it and running down, you know, just going down the sidewalk, almost floating, and this was in Chicago, and passing a police officer, and I felt like running up and just hugging him and saying, "I got a poem published," yeah. but I did. I refrained from that. But it was very exciting and to me at the time, and I was very pleased. And
now, just so listeners would know, did you get any money for that, or was
well, the nice thing was most magazines will send you one or two free copies of the magazine in which you're published,
right.
And. The money I've received has been very little and far between, except when I did receive an NEA fellowship grant, which is the National Endowment for the Arts. And I received that in 1995. That's a wonderful I felt like it was very fortunate. Felt very happy to receive that.
What did that enable you to do?
Well, you know what? I feel like the main thing it really – I guess for me it was an encouragement to continue mm-hmm. working. It was about $20,000, of which a fair chunk, of course, goes back to your taxes because it changes your income for the year. But it was probably the first sort of major acknowledgement that yes, you know, you're being taken seriously by other writers. Hmm. I'd had a couple of publications that I was very happy about. But that was the first thing where I felt like, okay, maybe I'm not – because you're always doubting. I still always doubt myself and think, oh, you know, this is just not going to work. No one's going to publish this particular one.
What were the publications you were most happy about?
One of the early ones was from Richard Jones in Chicago, who's the editor of Poetry East, and it's published out of DePaul. And I had read some of their work they'd published. They'd published a lot of poets that I had liked. And I really appreciated his – he had a very eclectic sense, would do translations, some original artwork that was really nice. And so I sent some poems in. He accepted them, and I was very pleased with that. And that was exciting.
And so. What else? Where else?
I've published in the Progressive magazine twice there, which was very pleased about. Would recommend anyone read the Progressive magazine. It's a great magazine published out of Madison of arts, culture, and especially politics. Had some poems published in North American Review out of, I think it's Cedar Falls. It's actually one of the oldest continuous publications in the United States. So that type of thing.
You mentioned politics is an interest of the Progressive magazine, and you do have a couple poems in the collection you brought today.
Yes, I do.
That deal with political issues. And I know you don't describe yourself as a political poet.
Right.
But we, as you say, we live in a time yes. when politics impinges on all of us.
Could
you give us a sample?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to. I guess what I'll read, I'm also, you may have noticed, I don't tend to write in formal verse, but sometimes it's a chat. It is, I listened to one of your shows with Kevin Stein, and he talked about his Crown of Sonnets that he wrote. And this one is called Changing Him, and it's a sonnet. And this one, unfortunately, is still very timely. It was written during the first Gulf War, back when any of you were around then, remember that was about 15 years ago now. So back when my son was a newborn. And this is both thinking about the war that was happening and about my son, who was a little baby at the time, and changing him. January 1991. My newborn on his back is like a beetle overturned with its frantic little feet doing a panicked dance that only scuttles the air and can't escape the robin's beak. My baby on his back reminds me of the war my nation's waging against Iraq. Men with arms and legs fly above and bomb a city sprawled out on its back. When I change his diaper, I touch his little head and chest as if touch could bless my boy and keep him safe. There's so much that could happen to a child. No less than any living thing. A bug on its back under a bird, or the people of a city under attack.
A sonnet entitled Changing Him, written in January 1991 by Matthew Murray, our poet in residence for the day here on this program.
Yes.
If this is the kind of program that you value as a listener, this is your last chance for our winter pledge drive to make a pledge of support. And if you would call 244-9455, you will get information about how to make a pledge. We're at $95,000. We had a goal of $100,000 for this week. So we're very close to meeting our goal. Of course, one person could do it with a pledge of $5,000. And I've been taught that unless you ask, you'll never get. So let me ask, if there's a listener who would like to help WILLAM reach its $100,000 goal for this winter pledge time, do call 217-244-9455. And of course, several smaller gifts could also help us get closer to that goal. So I encourage listeners who value this program, who value all the other programs here on WILLAM, to, if you've not pledged, please do. There are three times a year when we ask for support, and this is the winter time. You won't get another chance till May. So take advantage of this opportunity and call 217-244-9455 to make a pledge. If you'd rather do it online, you may just go to willpledge.org, and you'll find information there. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Matthew Murray. We try to respect the intelligence of our listeners, and, of course, dealing with important topics in poetry is one way to do that. We've just heard a poem read in a traditional poem form, a sonnet, dealing with the first war in Iraq, and now we're still in the middle of the second. I might take this opportunity to say that at the University Y this week, we're having an artist of a different kind do an installation piece dealing with the current Iraq war. Professor Thomas Albrecht of the University School of Arts and Design will be giving a talk this Wednesday at 4 o'clock on a piece called Us and Them. It was in the Faculty Arts Show back in the fall, and sadly it's still very relevant. It deals with the deaths of U.S. soldiers and with estimates of the deaths of Iraqi soldiers and civilians in this war. And each Monday at 10 o'clock, Professor Albrecht comes to the Y and adds to the tally on each side. He'll be talking about it Wednesday at 4 o'clock. It's open to the public. It'll be just an informal talk and time for question and answers. But it's a very moving piece, very simple, and yet very, very profound. So that's at the University Y in Champaign, 1001 South Wright Street, easily accessible by bus, public transportation. And that time of day, you can usually find parking even on the streets if you need to drive. So Wright and Chalmers, 4 o'clock Wednesday, Professor Thomas Albrecht talking about his piece dealing with Iraq, Us and Them. Matt, as the father of two children, one in high school where you're the librarian at Urbana High, the other coming up soon, how do you deal with being a parent of someone who might come into your library and here you are, a poet writing about, in some cases, your children?
Yes.
How do they react to that?
Well, it's a good question. I try not to push much on them as far as occasionally they'll listen. I participated in a reading recently at the IMC, the Urbana IMC in the old post office building We did a fundraiser.
Independent Media Center.
The Independent Media Center, and did a fundraiser for the Independent Media Center and the program, the Books to Prisoners program run out of the Independent Media Center. And my 13-year-old was there, and he commented on one of the poems I had read. And that was kind of interesting. I know my oldest, who's in high school now, I went and read some poems to his first grade class. I picked out a few that seemed would work for first graders. And he didn't mind it then. And to be honest, I feel like with a lot of the kids that come in the library, I'm one of my goals is both to make the library a welcoming place and to basically try not to to breathe down their necks too much, to make them feel welcome and not like I'm being real pushy on them. And I'll be honest, I see my son maybe 3 or 4 times a week in the hallway, and nod to him, and he nods back to me, and that seems to work just fine. And he's okay with I think he's a little more of a realist or a little more of a pragmatist maybe in the world. And he's like, once in a while, I'll be like, why do you want to work on something that just doesn't pay very much? Mm-hmm. And that's okay. I understand that. So I would say that's probably what happens there. But I noticed both my kids enjoy books and reading. So I'm happy for that. It's I think that's just a joy to be able to explore the world of books and ideas. And
how do you, as a poet, teach your children to appreciate reading poetry? And of course, as a librarian, you have the opportunity to also encourage other people's children. How do you do that?
Well, it's funny. I guess sometimes I've maybe felt a little guilty, like I should have been reading more poetry to my kids. But my wife and I both always read aloud to them a lot. And I guess when I think back to my own love of writing and literature, it had a lot more to do with appreciating that world that you enter into with language and just how powerful it can be and how freeing it can be. I know, growing up in Catholic upbringing and Catholic school, a lot of times it felt very rule-bound and restrictive. And I remember in 10th grade reading The Grapes of Wrath, and these people were so earthy, and they weren't guilty. They didn't feel guilty about the things they did. And it kind of blew my head open, I think, at the time. And the nun who was teaching English, she loved literature so much, and I don't think she quite meant to subvert me that way, but I think if you can just model for people how much you love writing and reading and respect it, then you just have to let them make that choice. So,
since this is a program that deals not only with values and ethics and spirituality, but also with religion,
yes,
you do have some poems in the collection you brought today that are explicitly dealing with religious
yes.
topics. Would you like to pick one of those
for
us? Oh,
sure. Let's see. I'll read the one called Catholic School, since you asked me about that one.
Sure.
In the beginning. I felt I have to confess, I felt a little funny coming on Keeping the Faith, because I don't consider myself much of a spiritual religious person. But I always tell people, I've learned so much from my religious upbringing, and I have immense respect for people who take their faith seriously. I guess that's probably, to me, what separates people that I really respect from people who I maybe am not so interested in dialoguing with is when people take their faith their faith seriously. I think it's a very interesting and compassionately.
When did you write Catholic School?
Well, this is one of my newer ones that I've been working on. And I guess for me, growing up Catholic, there's often a real emphasis on the Passion of Christ, which if people recall the Mel Gibson film, I think he focused exclusively on the torturous aspects of that. And I guess one of the things that maybe shook some of my own faith in my particular upbringing was, which I think shakes everyone, is trying to square all the suffering in the world with what you dream the world could be like. And especially if you, what you want the world to be like with God's power. And so this one was thinking about the images I grew up around and the hopes for that.
We'll be hearing Catholic School, written and read by its author, Matthew Murray.
And for those who've never gone to Catholic school, all the rooms have a little crucifix in them, and it's usually prominently displayed up in the front of the room. And then Catholic school. His hammered body hung in every room. Stations of the cross hung in a circle inside the church, circled his torments in the church of my mind. I believed he was God, suffering to wear the robes of human pain. Now I think he was nothing but a man. Soldiers, just men, who held him down, followed orders. Hammer, hammer, hammer. Oh, living muscle, nerves, and virgin bone. If only he'd been the last. Last sentence. Last nail. But there have been millions more. The rack, the screw, the boot, the wheel, the stake, the chair. All God's children are whelped in a kingdom of cruelty. A cross hung in every room.
Catholic School, a poem by Matthew Murray, our guest today on Keeping the Faith. We're at the 5:30 hour, about halfway through our program, and we've just heard a poem that brings up the whole issue of the problem of pain and suffering in the world. We'll solve that problem the second half of our program, I'm sure, with Matt's help. Let me take just a moment to remind listeners, you may give us a call with a comment or a question or dealing with Matt's poetry or a question for him as a writer.
Sure.
In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. And let me give a last reminder that if you'd like to make a contribution to WILL as part of our winter fund drive, we're very close to our $100,000 goal for this week. If you'd like to help us get past that goal, do call 244-9455. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, we'll be talking with Yusuf Estes, who is a guest in the community for the whole week, and he will be speaking a couple times in addition to being on Keeping the Faith on Sunday. On Thursday, February 16, he'll be in Gregory Hall at the University of Illinois. Free admission, of course, 7 p.m. He'll be talking about why preachers and priests are accepting Islam, which is the same topic he'll be discussing here on the radio on Sunday. There'll be a fundraising dinner and lecture for the Muslim Women's Outreach on Saturday, February 18, beginning at 5:30. That costs $10. There is limited seating. To get a ticket, go to muslimpreacher.com to get a ticket for that Saturday evening dinner, which will be at the University YMCA. The subject of his Saturday talk will be Christians, Muslims, and Jews, Holy Wars, or Big Business. So that's coming up this coming week. On Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Hillel Hakim, an Israeli journalist, on February 26th on this program. And then Alicia Banks will be talking about the YWCA here on Keeping the Faith the first Sunday in March. Alicia is the director of the YWCA, and I'd like to announce that they'll be having their 20th annual Black Women's Achievement Dinner, also on Saturday, February 18 at the Round Barn Banquet Center. President Zalima Harris from Parkland College will be receiving a special honor for her outstanding leadership and service to the community in this year of her retirement. Jeanette Osler, who founded the Black Women's Achievement Dinner 20 years ago, will also be honored at the dinner. Jeanette is now a teacher at Stratton Elementary School in Champaign. Tickets are $35 for adults, $17.50 for kids. Can be ordered by calling the University YWCA, that's 344-0721, or go to YWCAUofI@hotmail.com. So, tickets for the wonderful dinner at the Round Barn Banquet Center, February 18, are available at the YW, 344-0721 during the week. The YW's mission is to empower women and eliminate racism. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. I'm the director of the YMCA, coming up at our place this week on February 14, Valentine's Day. Professor Barrington Coleman of the university, director of the Varsity Men's Glee Club, and a wonderful soloist, will be presenting music for Valentine's Day. He'll be singing with piano accompaniment at the Y at noon as part of our Know Your University series. The music school, of course, is a very important part of the university to get to know, and Barrington Coleman's a wonderful example of that department. So bring your sweetheart and come at noon for a wonderful free program. You can buy lunch at the Thai Eatery if you'd like. Also coming up at the YMCA this week is Friday Forum, our lunch lecture and discussion series. We're talking about democracy at risk all this semester, and Jonathan Allen will be our speaker. He's a professor in political science. He'll be talking about democracy, human rights, and torture, going back to the theme of Matt's poem that he just read. The University Y also encourages people to support the Y by donating a vehicle. We accept cars, trucks, motorcycles, vans, boats, anything with a title. If you donate it to the YMCA, we will try to sell it for a good price, often to a student or someone in the community who's looking for a good used vehicle. And you may write that off on your taxes as a charitable contribution for the amount that we sell it for. If you'd like to donate a car, have questions about it, do give me a call. Steve Shoemaker at the University YMCA, 337-1500. Well, let's get back to our guest today. We're delighted to have Matthew Murray, who's the librarian at the Urbana High School and a published poet, in our studio reading some of his poems. Well, let's talk about the problem of evil. You discussed as a child seeing the crucifix of the passion of Christ, the suffering of Christ depicted on the walls of the school.
Right, sure.
In the last couple lines of your poem, you say, "All God's children are whelped in a kingdom of cruelty, a cross hung in every room of the world," you imply. So as you, as a poet, look at the suffering in the world, whether it's in war or poverty or racism or whatever, what good can you do?
Well, you know, I had a lot of conversations about that, particularly when I was younger.
I'm sure.
And you know what? I guess, honestly, probably not a whole lot. I haven't seen poetry stop any wars. Mm. And I think it can give people... read about people who remembered verses of poems mm-hmm. when they were imprisoned. I know after September 11th, a lot of people took comfort in poetry and in art, and that the humane forms. I think poetry reminds us, especially in ever since I've been a kid, I've heard language devalued by our devalued by our politicians from. You know, missiles called peacekeepers to, spreading freedom through war is absurd. And I guess poetry chafes at that and bristles and resents it and works against that. But I don't think – it doesn't mean that I feel like it's going to change the world. I feel like that I have to do by getting involved in my civic duties, getting involved as an activist. Preserving information for people as a librarian. I feel like those are all important elements of resisting what I see as the forces that are inhumane. So,
and doesn't poetry also hold up certain ideals, certain values that are contrary to things that lead to that kind of suffering?
I hope so, yes, I do.
I was looking at your list of sort of categories of your poems you brought
yes.
today, and you have things like peace, love, kids, parents, mm-hmm. as well as death and war and terrors. And
sure. I And I feel like we're living in a time frequently where I hear people, there is an us and them mentality, which I just reject that out of hand. And I reject out of hand saying that people who are terrorists are not human beings. I heard a lovely interview with a man who was a South African white activist who had been, I guess a car bomb had been put under his car by the white government of South Africa when he was an anti-apartheid activist. And they asked him about, you know, the reality of being a nonviolent person. And he just said something very beautiful, that he rejects, you know, demonizing and making evil the people you're struggling against, including the people who tried to kill him. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, now he can talk to those people. And that they're human beings. They have motives that he doesn't respect and honor, but I think poetry does try to find what connects us and not what puts us at each other's against one another.
Or at least some poetry does.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, of course. Yeah, that is a good point. And poetry can be, you know, twisted and used and set against you. So
sure. We have a caller on our local line, 333-9455. Happy to have others get in line. And you can also call us toll-free if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. You're on the air with our guest, Matthew Murray. Go ahead and line one.
I called earlier, but all I have to say is I think if you mean what you say and say what you mean, that helps. It combines faith and works. Mm-hmm. In other words, the only sermon most people see or hear is you, and that's my comment. I hang up and listen to your response if you have one.
Well, I can't argue with you on that, and I guess I often do feel like many faith traditions have some very simple but very powerful messages. I think, you know, for me growing up, the golden rule to do unto others as you'd have them do unto you just seemed a very succinct way of living your life. Which I don't see that happening with some of our leaders who say they are, you know, representing Christianity. But thank you. I think that's a nice comment to try to model what you want.
In a week where we've seen artistic art being used in the form of cartoons attacking the leaders of Islam, specifically the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and even reprinted locally here at the Daily Illini. As a librarian, I know you're sort of trained to take the freedom of the press, freedom of expression, freedom of speech very, very seriously.
Absolutely, yes.
But are there limits?
Well, it's an area of which, I mean, I've listened to some debates about it, and particularly as it becomes more and more of a topical issue, a universal issue, global issue, and people want to know what it's about. I think people are curious to see what has created such a furor. On the other hand, to pretend that this takes place outside of a context of a lot of Islamophobia, I feel like if you look in the newspaper, our local newspaper today, there's a political cartoon that I feel like has some of the grossest stereotypes of Arabic Muslim people, men with shaggy beards and screaming and yelling death to people. No attention to many, 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 probably a billion people who are organizing in peaceful protests and wanting to have some resolution. I don't think it's fair to just pull something completely out of context. I think it is especially in a country like ours where freedom of speech is held up as such a sacred ideal, it's tricky. I don't think it was necessary to publish them. I think you can suggest people look on their internet for them. I think you could certainly describe them in words to convey that. We talk about issues that are very, you know, controversial, like child pornography, without reprinting what got someone put in prison or that kind of thing. I don't think it's always necessary. But I think it's important to allow people who have been offended to give them some space to write about, to talk about, to make their point. But it's an issue I can see where someone might wrestle with it in the context of our media too.
Well, let's be sure to give you some more freedom of expression. Read us another poem that you brought.
Okay, sure. I'll read you a few. I haven't read any about my kids, and that would probably be a good place to go. And I mentioned feeling pulled by children and the demands of parenting. So I'm going to read Gabe's Teeth again, which I hope if anyone's been a parent and knows how when your baby starts growing teeth, they often become very cranky and upset and can't sleep well, and they hurt, and it lasts forever, it seems like. And so this is called Gabe's Teeth Again. Once more he cries out, stiffens away, then settles back on me, moaning himself to sleep. I used to get up at 4:30 every morning to write for 3 hours. I used to read for hours each day. I used to sleep through the night. But it's Gabe's teeth again, cutting and hurting his gums. On my chest, he whimpers even in his sleep. From my first son, I learned that it takes more than a year for all the teeth to cut through. No one ever told me that. Everything takes longer than I think. How many mornings has it been? More than 1,000. And what do I have to show for it? A mind that wanders, a sheaf of poems, the teeth in his mouth.
So, Gabe's Teeth Again, written and read by Matthew Murray, our guest poet on Keeping the Faith this week.
I better read another one. Sure. About my other son, Cy. He's a character when he was a little boy, from a very young age, was just compelled to look, maybe like his father in some ways, maybe to look at the dark side of things, was very interested in when something was dead. When we were driving down the road once and we noticed an animal by the side of the road, he insisted we stop and look at it, even though we thought it might shock him too much. But he wanted to know about that. Whenever he heard that a relative had died, he'd want to know, well, how did that happen? Or if he'd hear something on the news about the death penalty, how do they do that? How do they kill someone? And from a very young age. So this one is called Earth's Weight. And that one is just a couple pages past there. And he was also a child that was very interested in amounts, numbers, etc. So this one is called Earth's Weight for Cy. He knows we uproot burdock and hack down the musky trees of heaven. He knows we kill mosquitoes but spare killer spiders. He knows how cats and possums look when they get run over. Slick loops of veined intestines, bulged eyes, and choked out tongues. He knows the living die, but do not want to die. The worm tugged thin from dirt to bird. The hooked fish muscling for the water. The scared pig scuffing against the ramp. He knows we humans die and kill our own. He knows what soldiers are, what warplanes do. He's 4 and also knows numbers. 125 pounds, his mother. 60 minutes is 1 long hour. 3 million people live in the city of Chicago. He's only 4, but lately wants to know of wars. Tell me what wars you know about, Daddy. When I name one, he wants the number of people killed. The Civil War, 600,000. Is that more than 1,000? Can a person count that many? Tell me another war. And another. And another. He listens. The Persian Gulf War, 300,000. Vietnam, more than 2 million. World War II, at least 40 million. That's a lot, isn't it? Later he'll ask, why? And we will talk about money, land, hate, and following orders, but for now, he only wants the names and numbers, the numbers of the dead, numbers so large you couldn't count them in a single lifetime, like the number to tally Earth's weight, a number he loves to tell and tell, 6.6 sextillion tons.
Earth's weight for Psy. Psy was at the time 4 years old, son of our poet reading for us today, Matthew Murray. Children who are anticipating death, who are already already aware of it and realize they're mortal and realize that, that's what we all face. A heavy topic, Earth's weight.
And while it's interesting, I found it interesting too how there's certain things we keep secret from people and from children. And it was interesting because one of the questions he had was, well, how do they make meat? And I thought, well, that's a legitimate question, and looked for some children's literature on it. Couldn't find it, of course. The only thing I finally found was a textbook at the library that they use in the meat science department that just showed some of the basic, hammers that they use, or the electric prods that they use to basically knock the animal out before they actually kill it. But it was interesting. He just wanted to know.
Sure.
He wasn't in a... And it was funny to have to go digging and searching and looking and getting these sort of hints of maybe how it's done.
Has he become vegetarian?
No.
But he was curious.
Yeah, he was curious. Okay. Yeah. I think the only time he came close to it was we went to the Pioneer Days in Springfield, and they had a recently butchered pig hanging up from a tree dripping, and he took one look at it and said, "I'm not eating any more meat." So, yes.
Well, I have to ask a librarian, of course, what books you recommend. What books of poetry have been meaningful to you recently that you would want to share with others?
I have to say the university has hired a wonderful poet, and he read at this benefit that I participated in. His name is Tihemba Jess, he did a reading probably about 6 months ago at the Illinois Union Bookstore, and he's a gifted reader and a performer of his work. And unlike what I love about him is some poetry performers, they have the performance thing in spades, but their work sometimes maybe is a little thin to me. But he is just, his poems are textured and interesting and researched, and the language just is vibrant, and he uses many of the tools of alliteration and assonance and internal rhyme, and does some very unique things that are all his own. I've never seen anyone else do. He calls these double-jointed poems in two voices and reads them down one half the page, down the other half, and then reads them across as a whole. And just fascinating, and I think that's wonderful. And he read some poems by Etheridge Knight that were just stunning, particularly a couple of his prison poems. I've loved Sharon Olds, Adrienne Rich. I've loved Philip Levine, Gerald Stern. I'm often just – I like to just, go to the library and see what they've purchased in their new books and just take them home and read them over. I think that's probably the best way is for someone to just browse. There's lots of poets who I think anyone reading them will find that you don't understand them, and I don't either. And then if you keep going, you'll find some poets that really will connect with you. And everyone's tastes are different. And
is there a poet you recommend for freshmen in high school?
No, I don't. I wish there were someone that I could say that about. Mm-hmm. There have been some interesting anthologies recently. Of course, Best American Poetry comes out every year. It's worth looking at for someone who's just curious to see what's being written out there.
Sure.
Doesn't cover everything, but I think it's a good one.
We're down to our last couple minutes.
Yes, we
do
are.
Have a short poem for us to end with.
Oh, sure. I'll read this one since I'm a librarian. This was written before I became a librarian, but I guess it talks a lot about maybe some of the sadnesses of art and also the joys. And it's called Child Sobbing at the Library. Suddenly the quiet, that empty jug was being filled with crying. A child was sobbing, not the wailing of a slapped kid, and not the tearful screeching of demands and whining. No, it was a child crying for something lost or broken, something that will never be replaced. I listened, loving the sound, as I love a lone violin or muted trumpet slowly filling the bowl of silence. It was the crying that I've lost and will never have again. I wanted that child to cry and cry for everything I've lost, every love I've squandered, everything I should have done. Cry for my deaf father sitting hunched in front of his loud TV, for the house on Kenmore Street, for the tea we drank falling in love, for the novels I'll never read, for the great paintings hanging unseen all night in empty museums, for the cities of the world, all their joyful streets, all their terrors, for the dead and the way time shoves us along, ignoring every protest. Cry, child, and let it be the song trapped beneath this flat bone here where my ribs come together.
Child Sobbing at the Library, read by poet and librarian Matthew Murray, our guest today on Keeping the Faith. I want to thank Matt for coming and sharing his poetry.
And thank you, too. Appreciate it.
Appreciate his very effective reading. Thank you for our listeners who have, and for our callers. Coming up this week at the University Y, where I'm the executive director, Professor Thomas Albrecht will be showing his art installation called Us and Them that deals with the deaths in the Iraqi War. That's Wednesday, February 15 at 4 p.m. Professor Albrecht will be giving an informal talk, and there'll be an opportunity for questions and answers about his piece. Also coming up this week, the 20th Annual Black Women's Achievement Dinner at the Round Barn Banquet Center, Saturday, February 18. Tickets are $35 for adults, $17.50 for kids. You may order those tickets by calling the YWCA. You can ask for Alicia Banks, or the secretary there can take your order, 344-0721. Also coming up at the Y this week, Professor Barrington Coleman will be singing on Valentine's Day at noon. Come and hear some beautiful music. Bring a sweetheart if you care to. It'll be noon at the Y, 1001 South Wright Street. You can have lunch at the Y Eatery with some very good Thai food. And then Friday Forum, Jonathan Allen, Democracy, Human Rights, and Torture. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host. Next week, our guest will be the Muslim Yusuf Estes. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, plus-size, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start the first week of February. Information at 344-YOGA or on the web at yoga-cu.com.
Writer Judy Blume once said, "My only advice is to stay aware, listen carefully, and yell for help if you need it." Next time on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about listening and being heard with the authors of Are You Really Listening? Keys to Successful Communication. Psychologist Paul Donahue and Mary Siegel will join us following the 1 o'clock news. I'm Celeste Quinn. Join me for the Afternoon Magazine Monday through Friday here on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
The forecast for Champaign-Urbana and the area tonight, we're calling for some scattered evening flurries, then partly cloudy after midnight, low around 16. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the mid-30s. Northwest winds around 10 tonight, southwesterly 10 to 15 with gusts around 30 miles an hour tomorrow. You're listening to WILL Urbana, a listener-supported service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Show your listener support by calling in a pledge at 244-9455.
It's 6 p.m. This American Life.